I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. The State Department recently released an environmental impact statement on the Keystone XL pipeline and determined that it would not significantly exacerbate global carbon pollution. If built, the pipeline would carry 830,000 barrels of oil a day from the tar sands fields of Canada to refineries on the Gulf Coast. That's still an if. The Obama administration has not decided whether to greenlight this project or not, and they are feeling intense pressure from supporters and critics. We begin our conversation this hour with Juliet Eilperin, and she's White House reporter for The Washington Post, to talk about the politics involved in this pipeline decision. And Juliet, nice to have you with us once again on Radio Times.
Same here. Thanks so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. This environmental impact statement is described as not being a decision document. Translate that for us, if you would.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, it's probably confusing for a lot of folks who don't necessarily cover this so closely. There's something called the National Environmental Policy Act, and that's a law that's been around for decades, which asks, when you have major federal environmental decisions, that there's a technical analysis that's done which lays out the pros and cons when it comes to the environmental consequences so that policymakers know what's involved when they make an ultimate decision. So this has been going on for years due to a number of different factors, but ultimately the State Department has done an analysis where it looked at issues including the climate impacts of building this pipeline, the risk of a spill and other factors, and basically laid out all the possible scenarios that could happen. But interestingly, at the end, sometimes you say, what's the preferred alternative? What, particularly from the perspective of the individual or entity that's proposing the project, should you go forward, should you not? There was no preferred alternative. They did not weigh in on whether it makes sense to build the pipeline or not. That's going to be left for political people more senior in the administration.
So what is the administration waiting for?
Well, a few different things. So under the policy that's laid out in the timeline, they have to do something called a national interest determination. They now need to weigh a number of other factors in deciding, is it in the U.S. interest to have this pipeline built? And they will be holding public hearings. They will be receiving comments on this. Secretary of State John Kerry at this point gets involved in the process. He's been briefed on it. He will look at the documents and listen to the different factors. And ultimately, eight agencies get to weigh in on this question.
Wow.
And after receiving all that information, which could take 90 days, could be shorter, could be longer, ultimately the secretary or his designee will issue a decision. There are 15 days for any agency to object. If a single agency objects, it goes to the president for a final decision, or, of course, the president at any point could weigh in.
And the reason the Secretary of State or the State Department is involved in this is because it crosses the border between the United States and Canada?
Exactly. That's the only reason why the State Department normally doesn't usually weigh environmental questions like this has gotten involved. And they are the only agency that can issue a presidential permit to cross the border.
I was interested in some of your coverage of this, that some of this pipeline is actually built and operational. In fact, the southern end of the pipeline is going.
Right. So the southern leg, which goes from Steel City, Nebraska, down to the Gulf Coast refineries, started operating a few weeks ago. That actually eased a glut of oil that generally had been stuck in Cushing, Oklahoma, and so was seen as important to help ease the way. And that required some federal permits, including Army Corps of Engineer permits. But one of the things President Obama made clear, even as they were going back and forth on this decision, is that he would allow that to go through and wouldn't impede that process while the State Department was deciding this larger issue of the longer leg going from Hardisty, Alberta, into the United States.
And that's about 1,000 miles long?
Exactly, a little over, about 1,100 miles long.
And we're talking about a certain kind of oil coming from the tar sands of Canada. Juliet, help us understand what this oil is.
Yes, it's oil that's extracted from something called bitumen, which is kind of a mix of why it's called sometimes the tar sands. Sands, as it tends to be a more viscous material, which has to be diluted. And it is both more the process of extracting it is more carbon intense, and then in addition, when it spills, it's more difficult to clean up.
And these are, of course, all ifs. You know, if it is approved and becomes operational, this whole Keystone XL pipeline, it goes down to refineries on the Gulf Coast. Is that oil that then would be exported to other countries? Where would that oil go?
No one can give you a straight answer on that question, which is one of the interesting things that policymakers are thinking about right now. It gets refined at that point on the Gulf Coast, and some of it is likely exported as diesel products to Europe, for example. There's the potential that, again, some of it could ultimately go to China. At that point, you have different players involved, and no one has been able to say with certainty what percentage of the oil that's refined will actually be consumed in the United States and what percentage will be shipped overseas. And certainly the critics like to say that it's important that not all this oil is going to be used in the United States.
And so a question about whether, for instance, our gas prices would be lower if this were to go through, we can't answer that question yet.
We can't answer that question definitively, but most of the independent experts you talk to say that it won't have a huge impact on gas prices, and particularly in terms of lowering them, both because essentially we have a global market, oil's coming from a lot of different places, but also because, frankly, in the past, there's been gas that's been essentially stuck in the Midwest because there wasn't an easier way to get it down to the Gulf Coast refineries, and that has, interestingly, made gas prices a little lower in the Midwest than they would have been elsewhere. So it would be a stretch to say this is going to translate into significantly cheaper gas prices for consumers in the United States.
Is 830,000 barrels of oil a day, is that a lot of oil?
and,
you know, when looking at the totality of oil production?
Now, that's a good question. I don't know the, you know, absolute totality off the top of my head, but it's a significant amount. There's no question that it's a significant amount, and that right now, and this is the, you know, one of the key questions, there's no other easy way to transport that much oil from that region. In other words, there's another part of the Keystone Pipeline that's doing a roughly similar amount, but to get that additional amount out there would be more difficult. I believe something like 700,000 barrels a day are already going down in the original Keystone Pipeline.
And there are also questions, and I think a lot of disagreement about if this were to be green-lighted, how many jobs would be created, I guess temporary jobs and then permanent jobs. And you've looked at that, Juliet.
Absolutely. So the best way to put it in is that there's a category of two-year construction jobs, that in other words, over the course of 2 years, which is how long it's estimated that the pipeline will be built, the most recent State Department estimate is that it would be 1,950 jobs would be there over a period of 2 years. Now, once the pipeline is operating, we're talking about roughly 50 jobs to operate that pipeline. And so, you know, you hear very inflated numbers. They generally, when people are doing that, they will say, you know, this is kind of indirect jobs from the, you know, the grocery stores and the restaurants that are going to be supplying those folks. And these are high-paying jobs because they are union construction jobs. But if anyone tells you that it's over 2,000 jobs, you might want to get them to check their facts. And interestingly, President Obama has been consistent in emphasizing that. He has really questioned those larger job estimates, which is interesting.
Well, we know where a lot of environmentalists stand on this. We know where oil companies and unions stand on this. How about the American people? Where do the American people stand on the XL pipeline, assuming they've heard of it?
The majority of Americans do support it, so it depends on what poll you're talking about, but it's anywhere from the low 50s to certainly the high 60s. So now, interestingly, I think there needs to be more recent polling. The most recent polls we've seen were last fall, and as this debate has dragged on, certainly you've seen a slight reduction in the number of Americans who support it, and there's been considerable both advertising on the part of the oil industry and as well as activism by environmentalists. So people tend to be somewhat familiar with the pipeline project itself. And again, that is one of the interesting questions facing the White House. Even the strongest opponents of it don't think that you're going to get to a point where you're going to have the vast majority of Americans opposing it.
And can we assume that people that, at least on paper, have supported the Obama administration probably oppose the XL pipeline?
Well, that's a good question. In the most recent poll, which I believe was a Pew Research poll that was done in September, among liberal Democrats, you had a majority who opposed the pipeline. But again, it wasn't a huge majority. It was in, I want to say, in the low 50s who opposed it. So, you know, even among Democrats, you know, again, the most liberal ones oppose it, but it's not uniform.
This, of course, is an election year, although every year feels like an election year these days. Do you think the XL pipeline will be part of the election politics this year?
Absolutely. It's going to play certainly in some key Senate races where you have, for example, Democrats up for re-election who are more in favor of it than the president himself. Senator Mary Landrieu in Louisiana, Senator Mark Begich in Alaska, as well as some others. They clearly have been pushing for its construction and will be targeted, frankly, by both sides. Certainly they're going to be targeted by conservatives who say that it's their president that's holding up this project. But interestingly, environmentalists have shown a willingness to take on some of these politicians, to put them in the hot seat for backing the pipeline. And so you already have a liberal group funded by a California billionaire, Tom Steyer, who's floating the idea of targeting Mary Landrieu, who, interestingly, has just become the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee.
Oh, interesting. But there have been some spills along, you know, parts of this pipeline.
Absolutely. There have been some spills, and there have been also significant spills elsewhere in the country. And we saw a spill of this kind of oil in Kalamazoo, Michigan, that's cost more than $1 billion and is still not entirely cleaned up. We've seen an Exxon pipeline spill of, again, this kind of oil in Arkansas. And these spills, along with actually spills by rail, which we've also seen on the uptick, have certainly raised some of the environmental concerns that, you know, people have been talking about for some time.
Well, and about a minute before we have to say goodbye to you, Julia, but I mean, it's clear the Obama administration would probably prefer not to decide on this particular issue because it's so loaded. But it's clear that Canada is determined to sell this oil to someone, if not the United States, China.
Yeah, so they always love to say that they want to sell it to China, and there are reasons why, you know, there are reasons why they would want to do it. One of the things is, while it's difficult to build this pipeline going from Canada to the U.S., it's also difficult within Canada itself to build pipelines to the east or west coast, which is what they would hope to do. So, for example, they've encountered resistance from Canadians, including First Nation, the Indian tribes there. And so while they are also in the process of figuring out how to do that, it remains challenging for them.
And last question for you, Juliet, is how much division within the Obama administration on this issue? Can you tell?
It's a little hard to tell right now. They have been very tight-lipped about this, as you might imagine. What's interesting is they've had former senior officials, now that they're out of office, say they support it, including Tom Donilon, former National Security Advisor, the former Interior Secretary, Ken Salazar, recently came out in favor of it. Mm-hmm. And then you've had on the other side, Carol Browner, who used to be an advisor, the top advisor on climate change and energy, say she doesn't want the pipeline built. So I think the divisions that we're seeing by former officials give you a sense that there are some divisions within the administration itself.
Well, Juliet, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. That's Juliet Eilperin. She's the White House reporter for The Washington Post, talking about the politics involved in the pipeline, the Keystone XL pipeline decision. We have a guest waiting in the wings who has traveled along this pipeline route. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. It's All Rachmaninoff with the Philadelphia Orchestra this Valentine's weekend. Alexei Zuev performs the Fourth Piano Concerto, and Vladimir Yurovsky leads Rachmaninoff's The Bells. Valentine tickets at 215-893-1999 or philorg.org. Now through Saturday, Valentine's weekend at the Kimmel Center, all Rachmaninoff with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
I'm Marty Moscowane, and yes, I share your pain and frustration with the weather today. Another snowy, sleety day in the Delaware Valley. You could be staring at the weather on your TV or out the window, but you're not. You're listening to Radio Times, and we're very happy about that. We're determined to produce fresh programs every day so you can stay informed and be part of the conversation. Now, be part of the WHYY family and become a member. It's really very simple. You decide what this service is worth, $5, $10, $20 a month. Call 1-888-345-9499 or go to our website at whyy.org and make a pledge. I took pledges very early this morning from listeners who did their part and were enthusiastic supporters of WHYY. Please join them and become a member because we must meet our overall goal. We must stay on track. We're not there yet. Call 1-888-345-9499. Again, pledge online at whyy.org. We thank you very much for making that pledge. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The Keystone XL pipeline has generated a great deal of controversy and debate among oil companies and unions and environmentalists. But how many of the supporters or critics have driven along the route of the pipeline as it meanders through Canada and the Midwest? Our guest, Tony Horowitz, decided to do just that, to see for himself how the proposed pipeline is changing the landscape and the towns along its path. He spoke with men who worked on the pipeline, company managers, landowners, Native Indians, ranchers, environmentalists, and strippers who work in the clubs that have sprung up for his new book titled Boom. Tony Horowitz is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of Confederates in the Attic and Midnight Rising, and he joins us from NPR. And Tony Horowitz, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
So did you travel this Keystone XL pipeline as an agnostic?
Not quite. I feel climate science or climate change is the great challenge of our era, and I believe we should do everything possible to mitigate that. So I would say more in the environmental camp, but also with an open mind about the reality on the ground for the people and places along the route and the genuine economic benefits, and really open to all the arguments I might hear. So this is not a manifesto. It's really a curious person traveling through this region, trying to learn and hear what people have to say.
Well, and I have to say, I really enjoyed it because of not only the people that we meet that you introduce us to, but just all the sort of nuance of opinion. And it's hard to put people in these black and white categories, which I think so much define some of this conversation, especially about the XL pipeline.
Yeah, it looks very different on the ground than it does, from news dispatches in Washington. It really does have a tremendous impact on a broad swath of the continent. And you see both the economic opportunity being created, not specifically by this pipeline, which will create few jobs, but by the oil boom itself that will feed into this pipeline. And not just in Canada. This pipeline will also carry crude from the Bakken field in North Dakota. So there's tremendous economic opportunity on the one hand and tremendous environmental damage on the other. And both were very vividly on display as I took this long journey from the tar sands of northern Alberta down through all the way to southern Nebraska.
Well, in fact, you began your journey in Canada on what's called the Highway of Death, a highway I don't think I would like to drive. Describe it for our listeners.
Yeah, the tar sands region, the center of it is a very remote town in northern Alberta called Fort McMurray. And to get there, you have to take about a six-hour drive from the capital of Alberta, Edmonton, which is where I flew into. And there is so much truck traffic and logging trucks, oil trucks, not to mention moose, and constant snow. They don't take snow days up there because Fort McMurray is at a latitude more northerly than Moscow. It frequently goes down to 50 below. So the driving conditions are extremely hazardous. You also, frankly, have a drug problem. Fort McMurray, one of its nicknames is Fort McCrack. You have these well-paid oil workers who are, some of them, spending a lot of it on drugs. So you have just this mayhem on the road, and it's statistically, one of the most dangerous roads in North America.
Well, and we're talking about, in many ways, especially some of these towns or even these camps, a largely male transient population, and along with that comes strip clubs and, I guess, prostitution. No surprise there.
Absolutely. You have it's sort of the way I imagine it's a modern version of a Klondike gold rush town. You have a mostly male population flooding in from all over, making big bucks in this industry, in this, heavily male environment. They live in what are called man camps, these grim compounds out in the mining region. And, you know, unsurprisingly, on payday, they pour into Fort McMurray to the casinos, the bars, and yes, the strip clubs. And I interviewed one stripper who makes $10,000 a week.
Wow.
Dancing in Fort McMurray. So it's quite a wild scene of these people making money and then also all these other people who are happy to relieve it of them.
You also describe in really vivid detail, and I should say to our listeners, we've posted some of your photographs on our homepage at whyy.org/radiotimes. And one of those pictures is of, and I don't even know how to describe it, because you say it's beyond landscape. I'll just quote some of the things that you say about what these, I guess, these tar sands look like. You say you couldn't even call it a landscape because there's almost no trace of land around the mines. The earth has been peeled of its skin.
Yeah, I used to be a foreign correspondent. I've visited mining and drilling sites around the world. Tearing minerals out of the earth is never a pretty business. That being said, I have never seen a landscape like the tar sands. And as you said, quoting from my book,
yes.
You can't even call it a landscape. The forest and wetlands that were once there have been drained and rolled up like so much carpet. And the earth has, yes, been peeled down to a depth of about 200 feet so that machines can get at the oil-rich sands beneath. It's a strange moonscape. It looks like a mining colony in outer space out of some science fiction movie. There's just nothing natural. There are all these ponds that are not really ponds. They're runoff from the mines. And they're toxic. If birds land there, they die instantly. So it's this just, yeah, very eerie, poisoned environment.
With these giant trucks, yes?
Yeah.
Giant.
Mining tar sands puts the heavy in heavy industry, literally the biggest machines on Earth. Just to take the mining trucks, which I saw a lot of, these are the largest trucks in the world. A man I spoke to who was driving one of them described it as driving a house. They're that big. The wheels alone are 12 feet high. This presented a real problem for me. I was, frankly, kind of sneaking around in a hard hat and coveralls in a small vehicle trying to see what I could. And I realized very quickly that these mining trucks couldn't even see me.
Wow.
And that, you know, if one of them ran into me, they wouldn't even know they'd hit me. And I would be like Wile E. Coyote, just, you know, flattened on the road. So, everything is on this just sort of Goliath scale.
Making the highway of death a true possibility.
Yeah, that was an extended highway of death. And I won't get into the moose, who are really one of the other great hazards of roads up in that part of Canada.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Tony Horwitz, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's written an e-book. It's called Boom, and it's subtitled, it's a long one, Oil Money, Cowboys, Strippers, and the Energy Rush That Could Change America Forever, A Long, Strange Journey Along the Keystone XL Pipeline. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Send us an email. Any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. I have to say, I was really taken with so many of the people that you met along this route. And I wonder, was everybody so interesting?
Well, I think anyone who's been a journalist knows you leave a lot of your material on the cutting room floor and try to include, the most interesting material and the most interesting characters. So, no, of course, not everyone was so captivating. But I did meet just an astonishing array of colorful characters. You have people just flocking from all over to both the tar sands and the oil region in North Dakota, many of them quite desperate. And a lot of them liken it to being in prison, and some of them are speaking from personal experience. They talk about sort of doing time in the oil fields so that they can earn enough money to go home and pay off their debts or buy a home. And they live, again, in these, you know, terrible cubicles that are like prison cells. So, you know, they and then the people in the mostly very rural area along the XL route, just, yeah, it's a wonderful slice of North America.
In fact, you say it's quite diverse because there are a lot of immigrants, I guess, that have been mm-hmm. drawn to the region for the good-paying jobs.
Yeah, to begin with, northern Alberta, I mean, here you are in this, you know, far, far north, and you've got a tremendous number of Somalis, Moroccans, South Asians, people flocking there for the opportunity. And the same is true in North Dakota, which is really a U.S. version of Alberta, this unbelievably you know, booming oil area where you meet African Americans from Mississippi, Hispanics from California and Florida, working class whites from all over who are just, you know, just flooding into this area in hopes of, you know, making a quick buck. So you have a surprisingly diverse population in a part of North America that's not really known for its diversity.
I'm curious whether you had their conversations were in any way different in Canada than they were in the United States, as you talked about jobs, the environment, the pipeline, all of those issues. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, Alberta, first of all, is not like eastern Canada. It's really in some ways the Texas of Canada. It's more conservative than the rest of Canada, and it is just this area where I felt people are really drunk on the oil and the money that it provides. And in fact, all of Canada is really benefiting from this. So Canadians have a chip on their shoulder about our opposition to the XL, even environmentalists, sort of, why are you picking on us? What about coal-fired plants in your own country? What about your habits, your addiction to fossil fuels that is really feeding this? You know, clean up your own backyard before you come after ours. So I heard a lot of that.
Yeah, in fact, one of the environmentalists that you talked to in Canada said, I've had people flying a private jet to get to Fort McMurray or groups with panda logos showing up when three rented Escalades. Then all they want to see and hear about is the destruction caused by digging for oil they burned to get here. Ouch.
Yeah, and, you know, it's hard to argue with that. And I think we're all culpable here. We all, you know, look, the carbon footprint from my road trip was enormous. We all have to deal with this, you know, together. And we're not going to go cold turkey overnight. But I think we all need to think about that consumption. And I think that was a fair criticism on the part of Canadians.
A representative from TransCanada said something to you that I won't say it haunted you, but it sort of mm-hmm. you kept coming back to it. And what he said was very simple. Product will find its way to market. Why did that stay with you?
Because what he also said that stuck with me, and believe me, I don't want to be a mouthpiece for TransCanada or the oil industry, but I think it's a good point that this is a little bit like our futile war on drugs, that the problem here is really demand, our own appetite for oil, and that trying to stop production and transport is really a hopeless mission. And I do kind of believe that from what I saw in Canada, actually, not that many people seem concerned about whether the XL is going to be built or not. They are ramping up production insanely. Other pipelines are going in every direction, new rail terminals. So I do feel when there is demand to the degree that there is in this country and around the world, it's very hard to solve the problem by, you know, trying to go after the production and transport in the same way that we failed to do that with drugs.
Let me get some callers in. We have, looks like Eileen from East Falls to join our conversation. Eileen, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm so glad you called me next because I really want to respond to this thing about our complicity in creating the demand. I'm a Philadelphia mother of two teenagers, and over the course of their lives, I've gotten more and more concerned and alarmed about climate change. And my first impulse was to try and limit my own consumption. I compost my banana peels. I turned down the hot water heater. We got solar panels, tried to take the bus more. And a few years ago, I just reached this point of despair and realized that none of it was enough, that we have to change the big institutions. We have to really challenge you know, fossil fuel dependency and especially extreme extraction, which is why exactly a year ago today I committed civil disobedience for the first time around the Keystone issue. There was a civil disobedience in front of the White House right before the Forward on Climate rally. And since then, I've been part of a local effort. We've done 5 trainings in Philadelphia to prepare other Philadelphians to commit civil disobedience around the Keystone issue if it looks like the Obama administration is going to approve it. Because I think we really need collective action to challenge the way we do business. Individual efforts to take the bus more are just not enough.
I appreciate the call mm-hmm. to Radio Times. And Tony, I'm sure you've heard some version of that. I think we all have.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is you hear it out along the XL route. This is not only happening in Washington and Philadelphia and liberal environmentalists. What's really striking, it's particularly in Nebraska, the XL route passes through politically one of the reddest parts of the country, these very rural, overwhelmingly white counties that some of them voted 80% and more for someone other than Obama in the last election. So you were talking about a very conservative part of the country. And even there, at least particularly in Nebraska, you have people rising up, in that case, less over climate change than over the threat they see to their water, to their property rights, to their agriculture, and forming this very unlikely coalition with urban liberals, with environmentalists, but most interestingly to me, with Native Americans who have been staunch foes of this pipeline. And I attended a gathering of a group that calls itself Cowboys and Indians, these sort of burly ranchers in deer work caps and camouflage jackets with Sioux activists, you know, meeting together to pledge to fight this. So even if it's approved, I think you're going to see a tremendous amount of opposition on the ground, in the courts. Over 100 landowners in Nebraska whose land this would pass through have not given permission. It's going to be a drawn out struggle.
It's interesting to look at it through that lens about land, I guess, and mm-hmm. and or both together, and property rights, because I think for many mm-hmm. Americans, property rights are, you know, one of those things we hold very dear. Mm-hmm. Broadly speaking, Native Americans have this very spiritual relationship with the land, and it's interesting to see those two coalitions, I guess, come together.
Yeah, the property rights, again, it's something we don't hear a lot about, you know, on the East Coast. But for people along the line, it's a huge issue. The issue of eminent domain, which we're familiar with, say, utilities, that if it's in the public interest, you can put in a utility line through someone's property. In this case, it's a foreign corporation, a multi-billion-dollar for-profit corporation that is using eminent domain to force landowners to give access. And this has really enraged ranchers and landowners all along the line.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Also, continue our conversation with our listeners. Yes, we know it's snowing outside. That's why you're listening to Radio Time, so you can join our conversation. And we are talking about the Keystone XL pipeline. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Again, our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tony Horowitz, and he's written an ebook. It's titled Boom. I'm going to give you the subtitle again because it's really what we're talking about. And it is subtitled Oil Money, Cowboys, Strippers, and the Energy Rush That Could Change America Forever, A Long, Strange Journey Along the Keystone XL Pipeline. He took that journey, and he's our guest in this hour of Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive DBA.
I'm Marty Moscowen. We are determined to finish this winter membership campaign, even if the weather is not cooperating. We know exactly how you feel as another storm unloads on the area. We're here for you through rain, sleet, hail, and snow, providing the kinds of programs that you expect from WHYY. And like you, we have bills to pay. Make a pledge right now, and here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. You can pledge online at our secure server at WHYY.org. We will reach our overall goal of 8,400 pledges, one call at a time, especially if you are one of those callers. Think of what you get every day here at WHYY, a mix of news and interviews that are unique and handmade and only available because of our business model. We rely on our listeners for about half of our operating budget, kind of crazy when you think about it, but it's a model that has worked for decades. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks for that pledge. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, talking with Tony Horowitz about the trip that he took along the Keystone XL pipeline. We have posted some of his really gorgeous photographs on our homepage. You can check them out at WHYY.org/Radio Times. And you can join our conversation at 1-888-477-9499. I want to ask you about this guy named Jim Ness. And as a writer, you know, one wants to find someone like Jim Ness. A really interesting fellow. And when you first meet him, he says to you, you know, I'm a bit of a redneck. He's a Canadian. I'm a bit of a redneck.
Yeah. This was one of many unlikely encounters and just shows how you can never put people in pigeonholes or, you know, people are very complicated. So I heard that there was this rancher in Alberta who had led the opposition to having the pipeline go through his and other people's property, put up a big fight. And that's really all I knew about him. He lived in this very remote area, and sort of driving there, I imagined a sort of, you know, a greenie, a back-to-the-land greenie who would give me herbal tea or something. Instead, I'm met by this brawny guy who describes himself as a redneck, and in his political views, kind of was. He's a total libertarian, obsessed with property rights, and that's really what drew him into this fight, that he feels landowners have no say in you know, whether this pipeline goes through their property and then how it is done. And also there are other issues that, again, you know, you don't think about until you're out there. Companies can simply abandon these pipelines. If in 20 years it's not economical, they can just decommission them, and then the landowner is left with the risk and liability of a pipeline rotting away under their land. So there are many issues around the land that he and others really brought home to me. But yes, I was surprised to find myself with a fairly right-wing evangelical as well who wanted to oppose the XL.
You asked him if he was a closeted tree-hugging pinko. Not exactly your words. And he says, well, there aren't many trees to hug here.
Yeah, this is another thing that's very striking about this landscape you go through. It's from really where the pipeline begins in Alberta until you get to Nebraska. You see very few trees. You are going through semi-arid plains, really a northern version of the Dust Bowl, really very depopulated areas. You go through a lot of literal ghost towns, and I found that, you know, just quite fascinating as a road trip through North America.
People seem to be very welcoming. You had, you know, invited into people's houses. You had what sounded like gigantic meals with lots of meat.
Yes. Well, I think my favorite spot was rural Montana, and this is eastern Montana. It's not, you know, the kind of groovy parts of western Montana that perhaps tourists are more familiar with. This is, again, quite bleak, empty plain, very depopulated. And what I loved about it is a lot of these towns, the only business is a saloon, and everyone's there. So I was kind of down to about 5% liver function by the end of this trip because I did a lot of my reporting in bars. And in these bars, it's completely lawless. You have kids in there. They're not drinking, but they're hanging out, you know, six-year-olds while their parents are drinking. You have 12-year-olds driving. One bar I went to, they do a old-time gunslinger thing, you know, draw, cock, and fire in the bar with wax bullets, not, you know, lethal bullets. It's really the Wild West out there. And, yes, hugely hospitable. I was really almost, drowned in hospitality and fed to death.
You were, though, marched out of a strip club in Williston.
Yeah, North Dakota. Yeah, how much lower than can you go than to be kicked out of a strip club in possibly the skankiest bar district in America? And I'm not going to give that story away.
No, don't.
But Williston is in the center of this insane oil boom. And it's an even rawer, rougher version than what I saw in northern Alberta. And you have, yeah, frequent knife fights, brawls, drugs, prostitution. It's really one of the wilder and more colorful places I've ever been. So, yes, I went on an extended pub crawl through the the dives of Williston, ending whatever with me on the curb having been escorted out of the strip club.
One of your photos that we did post on our homepage is of, it looks like the burn off of some of these spills. And one of the things you say is that the flaring wells in, is it Bakken?
Mm-hmm.
Can be seen.
And if I can give a plug for NPR, there was a wonderful series on this, I guess last week or the week before, a reporter who spent about a week in the Bakken. And one of the environmental, you know, really tragedies out there is they're getting at the oil beneath, but this kicks off a lot of natural gas and other things that are simply just burned off and wasted. Mm-hmm. Just an immense amount of carbon is just being emitted without heating a single home. And when you drive through it, particularly at night, it's like driving through a Hieronymus Bosch painting, if you remember that from your art history class. You know, these hellish landscapes with, you know, fires in every direction. And then I went to this farm where a pipeline had ruptured and spilled an enormous amount of oil across this farm. And as the farm woman put it to me, you know, this used to be a wheat field and now it's an oil field. It's going to take 2 years to clean up. And no matter how many safeguards you put on pipelines, as someone else put it to me, a pipeline's like a roof. Eventually it's going to leak. And so there, quite aside from the climate change issue, there's tremendous risk to all the places along this line.
Did people talk about climate change? Did they use those words when you talked to them?
On the U.S. side, frankly, not a lot. Going through a very conservative part of the country, I met a lot of climate change deniers. In fact, I would say most of the people I met in Montana, Dakotas, really didn't even want to go there. I think it's overhyped. But, you know, there are others, some who have really, I would say, have had their heads turned. And again, you see it most vividly in Nebraska. People who will say to you, you know, I never listened to this. I never even met a Democrat before.
Really?
I've never done public speaking. And now here I am going to rallies in Washington. So I think through the threat on their land, a lot of people are thinking about these issues for the first time.
About another minute before our second break here. What do people say about President Obama? What's the consensus?
Yeah, there's, believe me, a lot of Obama bashing out there. And one thing I sensed is that those who support the XL are doing it in part because the other side they perceive is supporting it, even though Obama has been equivocal on this issue and labor unions and others on the Democratic side have actually supported it. Their notion is that this is a cause that's been embraced by the left, and therefore they have to take the other side and fight it to the last ditch. So there's certainly a strong political dimension to this, and no, I'm Obama is very unpopular in most of the places I went through.
And that's Tony Horowitz, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's the author of several books and a brand new ebook called Boom, Oil, Money, Cowboys, Strippers, and the Energy Rush That Could Change America Forever. And it's what he learned going along the pipeline. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Elaine from, it looks like, Galloway, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Elaine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have two major concerns. I'll try to be quick. One is TransCanada is an extremely untrustworthy company. I lived in Canada last winter and listened to the CBC a lot. And last week, the CBC reported that a natural gas pipeline that TransCanada runs had exploded in northern Alberta a few years ago, and the report of it was covered up. It had shot flames 50 meters into the air, and they just covered up the report of this explosion. So they're probably covering up they'll probably cover up leaks, too. There have already been leaks reported in Texas. And I have friends who live in Nebraska who own property that this pipeline would go through. And they're very concerned not only for their property, but if there's a leak, the oil would seep into the Ogallala Aquifer and destroy the drinking water for the entire state of Nebraska. And that's just an environmental risk, let alone the climate change. That's just an environmental risk we can't take. And that's my opinion. I don't know if you wanted to comment on that.
Sure. No, absolutely. Elaine, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Tony, go ahead.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. I should have made that clear. In Nebraska, it's really two things. It's property rights, but perhaps even more so the risk to this aquifer that underlies almost all of Nebraska and is to Nebraska what, you know, sun is to Florida. This is really what sustains their agriculture. And there's a lot of fear for a spill in the aquifer. And the really scary, and Juliet mentioned this at the top of the hour, there was a horrible spill in 2010, not a TransCanada pipeline, but Enbridge, carrying tar sands oil that got into the Kalamazoo River. And without getting deep in the weeds on the chemistry, this heavy oil is diluted so it can flow. Once the diluted chemicals put in to dilute it evaporate, this heavy oil sinks to the bottom. So the cleanup is really one of the costliest and most difficult ever in North America. So we're talking about a type of oil that presents a particular hazard. So I think this is a big part of it. I'll just add, we talk a lot about rail, and I heard there's another rail accident in Pennsylvania today. And the industry loves to say, if it doesn't go by pipe, it's going to go by rail, and that's more hazardous. Another feature of this oil is that because it's so heavy, it's not as volatile as conventional crude. So it's actually less likely to cause the kind of explosion that we saw, for instance, in Quebec, tragically last year, where 47 people died. So there are a lot of very complex issues around the transport of this substance.
And Tony, you saw something that's described or called oil can trains. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. Well, this is in North Dakota and Montana. There is so much crude pouring out of North Dakota at the moment. It's the second biggest oil-producing state now. It's past Alaska. It's just behind Texas. And 75% of it moves by rail. So you see what they call oil can trains that are just 100 or more cars filled only with crude, just going past, you know, long waits at train crossings while these, you know, more than a mile long oil just pouring out. And there have been a number of accidents in North Dakota. So this is a real concern as well as all this oil comes out of the ground.
What does the pipeline look like? I mean, literally, what does it look like?
You know, I hate to say it's not very interesting. Parts of it, as Juliet said at the top, parts of it have been built. I saw other pipelines under construction. You know, you dig a ditch about 5 feet deep. You put a pipe in there. You weld it together, and then you cover it up. It's a 36-inch diameter, you know, needle, basically, bringing this substance, you know, into our veins here in America or abroad. The pipeline itself is not a particularly dramatic thing to look at.
Did traveling along this pipeline confirm, cement, change your mind about the XL pipeline?
I think what it really woke me up to was that the pipeline is just part of a much bigger story. If you put together all the oil being produced now in the U.S. with Canada, we are really fast becoming the new Saudi Arabia. We are an energy powerhouse. And I don't think we've come to grips with that much larger issue and what it's going to mean for our economy, for the environment, obviously, and also for foreign policy. Just to expand on what Juliet said at the top, if this XL is built in combination with the Keystone that exists, it'll bring about 1.3 million barrels a day to the Texas Gulf Coast. That's roughly equal to what we import currently from Saudi Arabia. Mm. So we are really in an era of energy transformation, and that's even before we get to all the natural gas that's being fracked. And I think we really need to have a national conversation about that.
And that's Tony Horowitz, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Tony, I thought it was interesting that you ended up, you know, traveling along this pipeline, and you end up seeing people building gigantic turbines for wind power sort of along this same route.
Yeah, the endpoint of the XL, which is, again, just one piece of this large Keystone network, is this tiny town of Steel City, Nebraska, where, again, the only business was a saloon. And when I went to visit there, they said, oh, by the way, you might want to see the wind farm. And the largest wind farm I've ever seen is just being completed right next to what will be the terminus of the XL. You can literally stand at the TransCanada pump station, and in the background are all these windmills. And it really brought home to me, you know, again, this curious era we're in, where there will be this mix of energy sources. And certainly the region that I pass through, the prairie and plains, sometimes I'd get out of my car and almost be blown over. So clearly this is this other resource waiting to be tapped. And that's another big piece of this conversation.
I'm just about a minute before we have to say goodbye, but I'm just curious about whether you think Americans are really ready, because of our reliance on fossil fuels, really ready to have a hard, cold conversation about the impacts of our behaviors.
Yeah, we're all addicted to this substance. I love the freedom of the road and the skies as much as anyone else. We're all going to get horrific heating bills, you know, this winter. We're all part of this problem, and I think we need this conversation to continue and to see the costs. Because, again, if you're in Philadelphia or D.C., where I am today, you don't see the damage to the land that is occurring because of this mining and drilling of this product we all depend on. And again, that's before you get to the climate change issues. So certainly I think we all need to be aware of this and just think, you know, even the woman who spoke about the little that she does in her home, if we all did that, it would be a start. So I think we all have to be more conscious of our energy addiction.
Well, on that note, Tony Horwich, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and his new ebook is titled Boom, subtitled Oil, Money, Cowboys, Strippers, and the Energy Rush That Could Change America Forever, A Long, Strange Journey Along the Keystone XL Pipeline. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can look at the photographs that we have posted that Tony Horwich took along his travels. And do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.